Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Sue Scott was in her mid-30s when she was diagnosed with cervical cancer. She had chemo, she had radiation, but it wasn't working.
The cancer is like this little bug in your ear that you hear all the time if you slow your thoughts enough, that you hear your mind saying you have cancer, you have cancer, you have cancer. You're dying, you're dying, you're dying.
In 2012, her doctor had more bad news. He was pointing to all of the areas where her most recent scan showed signs of disease.
It looked like a Christmas tree, basically. There was, you know, disease everywhere. And so he said, you know, enjoy the time you have, enjoy your time at the beach, and just soak up the time with your family. And I said, well, okay, so are you recommending a treatment, though, for me? And he said, well, I mean, you know, it's not really anything to do at this point when it's body-wide.
Body-wide. Her doctor said there was no cure, nothing to be done, except...
He said, I mean, you could look into clinical trials, I guess. There might be something that would slow the growth or give you a little more time.
A little more time. Another option. Maybe to stay alive until a new treatment or breakthrough happens. Cancer treatment has evolved and improved in many small steps. There have been lots of victories along the way.
There are many people who, yes, they have cancer. You can take an x-ray and you can see it, but it is not growing and it is not impairing their quality of life.
But behind every new treatment option, behind every study that is published, there are years of research, lifetimes spent studying specific cells, people's hopes and suffering. On today's episode, breakthroughs in cancer treatment and the personal stories behind them. Up first, a look at immunotherapy. It involves training the body's immune system to find and kill cancerous cells. Reporter Carrie Sheridan has been following one researcher's work in a series of clinical trials since 2013. These trials were happening at the National Institutes of Health, or NIH, and Carrie talked to some of the doctors and the patients, like Sue Scott, who took part in them.
Sue Scott's cervical cancer, which had spread all over her body, had been caused by the human papillomavirus, or HPV. It's the most common sexually transmitted infection. Doctors think most of us encounter it at some point in our lives. Often it causes no symptoms, and the body clears the infection on its own. But in some cases, the infection lingers and causes cancer. These cancers often appear in the genital area, the cervix, or the head and neck. Doctors estimated Sue had less than a year to live. So she began asking around about clinical trials. Everyone, even her mom's doctor.
I asked him, if he had any suggestions. He said, well, he said, I know the top guy who's doing research for HPV cancers. He said, it's Dr. Hendricks over at NIH.
Sue was able to make an appointment with that doctor, Christian Hendricks. He was leading a first-in-human cancer trial at the NIH Clinical Center in Bethesda, Maryland. Sue got into the trial, and she remembers their first conversation.
And I said, so how many people are you treating? And he said, well, we have three right now. And I said, oh, you have three patients? And he said, yeah. And I said, and how many of them are responding to the treatment? And he said, well, none yet. He said, we don't have anybody that's far enough out to know whether this has worked. And I'm thinking, this is the best option there is this guy who has three patients.
The doctor with three patients had also been a cancer patient himself, an experience that changed his career. When Christian was in his late 20s, training to become a surgeon, he noticed his vision was blurry. It turned out he had a rare eye cancer. Treatment after treatment failed, and eventually his one eye had to be removed. After that, his depth perception was off, and he realized he wouldn't be able to become a surgeon.
I spent a lot of time around when I lost the eye trying to discern what it is that I'm called to do. And it became clear to me, and it's still clear to me.
He went back to do another residency, this time in internal medicine and a fellowship in medical oncology. He's been cancer-free for many years now, but his own experience as a patient keeps him motivated to find cures.
If my cancer were to come back, it would be fatal, and I wouldn't want something that slows it down or adds weeks of survival. I'd want something that completely eliminates it, something that solves the problem and lets me go on and live my life.
Christian led cancer research trials at the NIH for more than 8 years, and the search for something that could eradicate cancer had brought him to immunotherapy. He focused on cancers caused by the human papillomavirus, or HPV, for a specific reason. The cancer has parts of a virus embedded in it.
The reason why they're so intriguing is because this particular type of cancer clearly has things about it that are not human. It has viral proteins in it.
The immune system's T cells notice this and attack. In Sue Scott's case, Christian's team isolated some of her own immune cells that had already been trying to attack her tumors. These immune cells are known as tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes, or TILs for short. They were clustered around cancer cells, punching at them, but failing to knock them out. This is how Sue describes it.
I always say that they took cells, that there were some cells in my body, some immune cells that knew that I had cancer, that had found the cancer, and they were like little kind of, you know, pocket protector wearing, little dorky, little smart, but not so brawny cells. And they had found my cancer and they're like, hey, I think you guys should get out of here. You're probably not supposed to be here. And they took those little cells that were so smart, they took them out and they sent them to Kung Fu school.
Scientists isolated those dorky immune fighters, turned on and activated them, and then multiplied them into the billions and reinjected the cells into the patients. Now there was an army of them.
They were like, hey, they were like bouncers at 1 a.m., you know, like, your time's up, gotta go.
Sue had chemo, then got an infusion of her own cells. She stayed at the NIH for weeks, laying in bed, covered with a Wonder Woman blanket, her mom often at her side. Sue's hair fell out, she battled constant nausea, and was on oxygen day and night for a while. But gradually, she started to feel better. Within a few weeks, she was well enough to walk out of the NIH and go home. A month later, scans showed her cancer had shrunk significantly. 2 months later, it was gone. The treatment worked. Another patient in Christian's trial, a married mom from Kansas named Erica Wallace, also got great results. She was also in her mid-30s, had metastatic cervical cancer, and probably had less than a year to live when she got into the clinical trial in the summer of 2012. Erica was patient number two.
They said, we can't give you any guarantees. All we can guarantee is you're going to lose your hair. And I had a wig on, and I pulled it back, and I'm like, been there, done that. That doesn't scare me.
A month after the treatment, Erica felt well enough to go home to Kansas and recuperate. She came back to the NIH for scans 4 months later.
December 19th of 2012, I went and we did scans and there was no sign of disease. They were completely clear.
Her youngest son, Marcus, was with her in the room full of doctors. He was 9 at the time.
Marcus looked up at him and said, thanks for saving my mom. And at that point, there wasn't a dry eye in the room.
There were a total of 9 women in that initial study. The other 7 didn't respond as well. Their cancers continued to grow, and they eventually died. Sue and Erica continued to do well. By 2018, they both reached a landmark, 5 years cancer-free. A lot of people in the medical community think 5 years without cancer means a person is cured. The trial marked the first ever cure of cervical cancer using immunotherapy. I was there at the NIH that winter, covering this milestone for my news outlet, AFP, the French news agency. Christian was there with some survivors from his previous trials. Sue, Erica, a man named Fred from another trial. They were all gathered together in a room in the basement. They talked about regaining their lives after cancer, about raising children, their careers, going fishing, how their health was. Then in walked one of Christian's latest patients, Bernie Pippin. For Bernie, this was all very new. In just a matter of months, he was making a dramatic recovery from what had been a certain death sentence, cancer throughout his body. Bernie had spent years as a businessman, building a drainage pipe company in Ohio from the ground up and growing it into a multi-million dollar enterprise. He was proud of that. Bernie raised two sons, now grown, with his wife of 30 years, Joan.
Bernie was always a very strongest person in the room.
He seemed really strong to me, too. He had great posture, muscular arms. He was always smiling, and he had a real firm handshake. Bernie had been diagnosed with late-stage anal cancer when he was in his late 50s, after ignoring some symptoms and warning signs. By the time he found his way to the NIH, where Christian's latest trial on HPV tumors was underway, cancer had spread to his lungs, bones, and one of his kidneys. Chemo, radiation, and another type of immunotherapy had all failed. Bernie's lungs were filled with tumors, so many that doctors weren't sure he'd meet the criteria for the study. He needed to be strong enough to withstand the treatment. Bernie was determined to get into this trial. He rode an exercise bike, posed for pictures in the gym, and later told me that he showed those pictures to Christian to convince him that he was strong enough to be in the trial. Here's Bernie in early 2018. This recording isn't great. I just had a little handheld recorder.
I said, I got two pictures I want to show you. So I showed him the screenshot of the bike, and then I showed him a shot of Joan and I. And I said, I know my pulmonary function's horrible. You've told me quite a bit of this. So I get that. And I know there's a lot of bad stuff going inside my body, and I understand that too. But I want you to know there's a lot of heart here, and I believe in the clinical trial. And I believe in what you're doing here. And when you write your book on your success stories, I want to be in your book.
In the earlier trial that cured Sue and Erica, Christian and his colleagues at the NIH had extracted one of their tumors and the immune cells that were attacking it. And then they magnified those immune cells, growing them into the billions before reinjecting those cells into the patients. This time, using just a blood sample, they were researching how a person's immune cells could be genetically engineered to recognize and target cancer. Another first-in-human trial was underway. There would be 12 patients, and Bernie was patient number 5. He was injected with 10 billion genetically engineered T cells able to recognize and target an HPV protein called E7 in his cancer cells. 2 months later, his doctors were stunned at what they saw. Bernie's tumors, more than 100 of them throughout his chest and midsection, had almost entirely disappeared.
I remember sitting in my office with Dr. Norberg and looking at these x-rays and just being nearly knocked out of my chair by all of the cancer that was gone.
Yeah, I remember sitting at the desk and opening the scans with him, and we actually thought it was a different patient because it was just so dramatically different.
Scott Norberg is an assistant research physician at the National Cancer Institute.
This is one of the first studies to show that this type of therapy can be effective in a common type of cancer, and that specifically is HPV-associated cancers.
The process of genetically engineering patients' immune cells to recognize a protein in the cancer worked for 6 of the 12 patients in the study. 3, including Bernie, had dramatic responses. Their cancer mostly went away and stayed away for up to 9 months. Bernie entered the clinical trial in July. By the fall of that same year, he was feeling good. No more coughing, far less chest pain than before, and he'd regained 12 pounds of lost muscle mass.
I mean, he had a lot of good things happening. The tumor in his kidney hadn't grown. And we thought, wow, maybe this is the cure.
But Joan says there were some lingering concerns.
So around December at a Christmas party, noticed his tongue wasn't working correctly.
By March 2018, new tumors were found in the bones of Bernie's neck. Christian had a special rapport with Bernie and his other patients, being a survivor of cancer himself. So delivering the news that the treatment was no longer working was hard.
I mean, I really went into that treatment with Bernie and into that entire clinical trial with intent to cure people. Having to tell each one that their disease came back,
Bernie died in December 2018. This is the reality of cancer. Most times when cancer is advanced, the treatments don't work.
When it doesn't work, it's frustrating, and I take it personally. I do end up feeling even more the sense of urgency and the motivation to do better.
Christian says those losses do take a personal toll.
Of course, you become attached to each patient. I don't know if this makes me the best scientist or doctor, but I do get highly invested in each patient, and I take the outcomes personally. I've had colleagues tell me you can't take it so personally, but I do, and that's okay.
Christian and his team have spent years studying what happened, why cancer came back for patients like Bernie. They finally published a research letter describing their findings early this year in the journal Nature Medicine. They found that the treatment worked for a while because the immune cells did kill the tumors that contain those flags, those viral proteins from the human papillomavirus. They could see that, and they killed them off. But then new cells grew in other places, and those cells, in a very sneaky way, had mutated to stop showing the immune system their viral proteins. The tumors disguised themselves to avoid the very targeted immune cells that had been killing them off. It's almost as if the cancer learned exactly how to hide so it could keep growing. Researchers still aren't sure if the tumors grew resistance to the genetically engineered T cells in this study, or if they'd grown more complex and difficult to treat because of earlier immunotherapies that had failed in these patients. It all made Christian wonder.
If we were able to treat these patients earlier in their disease course, when there's less opportunity for resistant tumor cells to develop, would we have a much better chance of curing them? Bernie had about 100 tumors, and that might just be a very difficult situation to cure a patient.
Understanding what worked and what didn't helps move the science forward. And although Bernie and 10 others in the trial eventually died of cancer, their participation is helping others. First, by showing that the process of injecting genetically engineered T cells was safe. And second, by showing it had some effect, it could work.
Oh my God, it did help him. It did. It gave him, I would say, at least 6 months of quality.
That's Bernie's widow, Joan.
You know what? He didn't want to die in vain. He wants them to learn. He wanted them to learn, you know, learn from it so somebody else doesn't have to go through it.
And this science is moving forward. A phase two trial on the E7 receptor targeting the viral protein in HPV cancers is already underway. Christian's also working on a trial that would test the approach in patients who are in the early stages of HPV-driven head and neck cancers. Erica and Sue are both still doing well. Sue says some parts of her daily life still revolve around cancer, but in a different way now. She says she regularly helps people find clinical trials.
Because I want other people to get to immunotherapy and have more and more people have results like I did. I also feel like the responsibility falls on me to, you know, help other people get to the place I'm where I am. So to point them toward, you know, whatever's the most aggressive and new treatment that's available.
Her doctor, Christian, would also like to see the field of research move with more urgency. He wants more people to seek out clinical trials and do it early in the course of their illness. He'd also like to see the whole field of research change, mainly to speed up. He says researchers spend a lot of time weighing safety and risk, which he understands. They need to make sure not to harm their patients with unproven new treatments.
You know, if my cancer were to come back, I would be concerned about the safety of an experimental treatment, but what I'd really be concerned about is if the treatment would work and the 100% chance of dying from the cancer. This is something that my patients say to me all the time too, and we really need to take it into account and figure out how to do faster, better cancer research.
Christian knows what every cancer patient wants. They want their cancer gone. They want another chance at life. They want progress to happen fast. For The Pulse, I'm Carrie Sheridan.
Carrie is a reporter at public radio station WUSF in Florida.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about cancer and new treatments and research that keep patients healthy and alive longer. Lung cancer kills 18 Americans every hour, more than 130,000 people a year. For the past few years, that's more than breast, colon, and prostate cancer combined. For decades, doctors caught most lung cancers too late.
Life expectancy was literally less than 12 months.
Then in 2011, a way to detect this type of cancer earlier was rolled out, a way to screen, to make this cancer visible in the early stages. But it comes with some real risks, and so far participation has been slow. Now doctors are pushing to expand the test to millions more people. Dan Gorenstein from the podcast Trade-Offs recently looked into this lung cancer screen and what it means for patients.
Lung cancer deaths in the U.S. peaked in 1991. Gerard Silvestri says this peak was really a valley.
It was just a horrific disease. There were actually a few that were cured, but not many.
In the early 90s, Gerard was finishing his training in pulmonary medicine at Dartmouth. The New York City native says the four chemotherapy drugs available to his patients made him feel like David going after Goliath.
All of them were terrible, and you know, everyone's hair fell out. Everybody had stomach issues.
Other doctors had mammograms and pap smears to catch diseases earlier. Some of those screens had been around since the 1920s. But still, here in the 1990s, doctors like Gerard typically diagnosed lung cancer only after a patient felt something.
There are no pain receptors in the lung tissue itself. So the tumor either had to get big enough to reach the wall of the lung, had to spread outside, so go to the brain and cause headaches, or the bone and cause bone pain, or spread into the airway where there would then maybe cough up blood.
This is what made lung cancer so lethal. By the time patients showed up, the odds of surviving were low. Then, in the early 2000s, new technology upended how doctors could treat the disease. The CT scan, formerly called a computed tomography scan, caught fire. All of a sudden, doctors were using it to diagnose everything from pneumonia to kidney stones. Gerard describes this magical machine to me like being rolled through a giant donut, a donut that snaps cross-sectional pictures of your body.
And you're looking up and into those slices, and so you can see really tiny changes in the lung itself.
The National Cancer Institute in 2002 launched a massive randomized controlled trial, enrolling 50,000 people with a history of heavy smoking, lung cancer's biggest culprit. The question? Does an annual CT scan reduce lung cancer mortality more than a chest X-ray? It took nearly a decade to gather the data. By 2011, doctors had their answer. CT scans had cut lung cancer deaths by 20%. For two decades, most of Gerard Silvestri's diagnosis conversations went like this.
Look, we can hopefully control your disease, but I have to tell you, this of the deck of cards you've been dealt, this is serious, really serious.
With CT scanning, more conversations could go like this.
Hey, look, you know, we found this thing small. If you had to have cancer, nobody wants cancer, but if you had to have it, this is the one we want. And why is that? Because in 5 years, you know, we're going to be having a party, right? And like, I just want to put it out there now. I like top shelf vodka.
Doctors finally had a new weapon in their war with Goliath.
Thank you.
But like most innovations in medicine, lung cancer screening came with its own downsides and dangers, risks some doctors rarely discuss with their patients. Gerard Silvestri thinks the most common pitfall is so important to explain, he's come up with this analogy.
Think of the lung as a 2-liter bottle of Coke. And in the middle of that 2-liter bottle of Coke, there's something a pea-sized, right?
Once the CT scan detects the pea, doctors try to confirm if it's cancer. And that's when patients enter risky territory.
You refer the patient for surgery, so the surgeon operates. After the operation, the patient ends up developing respiratory failure and pneumonia. They end up in the ICU for 30 days. They end up getting a tracheostomy for complications, and they eventually get transferred out to a long-term acute care facility somewhere, and then they die. And, oh, by the way, it turned out that the thing that you took out was not cancer.
Gerard is clear. This is the absolute worst case, and it's really rare. The point, though, is when you use a super-powered camera to look for lung spots in people who have smoked for decades, they're pretty easy to find. Like in that big national trial, 1 in 4 people had a positive scan, but 96% of the time, that P was something else, maybe scar tissue or a harmless lump. Some got extra scans, biopsies, even surgery. A lot of worry and money just to find out they didn't even have cancer.
I'm less concerned that we're doing more harm than good.
University of Michigan radiologist Ella Casaruni heads up the National Lung Cancer Roundtable, a public-private coalition convened by the American Cancer Society. She's confident lung cancer is the beginning of a new chapter in screening history. One of the big differences, doctors have a lot more data, and they're using it. For example, the American College of Radiology in 2014 knew all of those benign peas in the Coke bottle were a problem and set out to fix it. They analyzed screening data from around the world and realized they could safely raise the bar on what counts as a suspicious spot from 4 millimeters in size to 6.
Now, that might sound like a tiny, tiny difference of 2 millimeters, but the majority of nodules we see are quite small. And so by raising that threshold, we've decreased the number of positive screens and a lower number of follow-up tests and diagnostic procedures having to happen.
The same group now tracks nearly every scan in the U.S., more than 2 million so far, on the lookout for other quality and safety issues. Medical University of South Carolina pulmonologist Gerard Silvestri says the evidence is strong. Those risks are worth it if you're really in danger of getting the disease.
So there's no question it works. The question is, can we increase uptake in the right population?
Unfortunately, the answer so far is no. The participation rate for common, albeit much older cancer screens like mammograms and colonoscopies is close to 70%. For lung cancer, it's about 6. A panel of national disease experts, known as the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, first recommended lung cancer screening in 2013 for some 8 million people. The good news is that researchers now have a better handle on the barriers that have kept this medical breakthrough out of reach for most. The bad news, these obstacles are tough to overcome. The first is awareness.
Mammography and breast cancer screening is cocktail conversation. It's, you know, conversation on the sidelines of sports games. Lung cancer screening isn't there.
University of Michigan radiologist Ella Casaruni calls this test the toddler of the cancer screening world, still really new to both patients and providers, especially in primary care. But both breast and colon cancer screenings had uptake rates around 30% in their early years, according to the American Cancer Society. So Ella chalks some of the problem up to lung cancer's conspicuous absence from the national stage.
We still talk about the Katie Couric effect today in colon cancer screening.
Hi, everybody. Here we are in my kitchen. It's about 18 hours before I get my first colonoscopy. And here's my cherry-flavored New Lightly. This is
when you look at lung cancer and try and find your Katie Couric, it's really challenging. People don't want to have their legacy associated with something that they feel is stigmatizing.
Stigma dogs the world of lung cancer. About 80% of people diagnosed with lung cancer have a history of smoking.
It's almost like a scarlet letter.
Lisa Carter-Harris, a nurse practitioner and behavioral scientist at Memorial Sloan Kettering, says the disease suffers from a double standard.
If someone tells you that they had a heart attack, do you look at them and say, oh, you're not vegan and you don't run 3 days a week? We don't do that. But if someone tells you they have lung cancer, what's the first thing people say? Oh, I didn't know you smoked.
Lisa says stigma doesn't just get in the way of celebrity endorsements and ad campaigns.
I was actually doing research on people who were diagnosed with lung cancer and having them tell their story.
She found stigma affects people who smoke so much, they're delaying important care.
You know, I had one patient say, I just feel like I'm taking up resources. You know, I did this to myself.
Lisa hopes the more forgiving attitudes towards opioid use spill over to people who smoke, shifting from a moral failing towards suffering from a hard-to-beat addiction. The other big drag on screening growth? There's a lot of hoops to jump through. Talking with your doc about smoking, finding a hospital with a CT scanner, coming back year after year, the list goes on. Those tasks may be easy enough for some, but Gerard Silvestri points out smoking is much more common among the uninsured and people with low incomes, the kind of people who might not have primary care or time off from work.
So all these other social determinants come into effect. And I think people are completely underestimating this, like wildly underestimating it. For all of lung cancer screening, because of that demographic of where smokers lie, education, insurance, socioeconomic status.
There's a third and final lesson researchers have learned over the decades screening's been around, and there's a much easier fix. In fact, it's already happened.
A federal task force is rewriting the rule book when it comes to the number one cancer killer.
New recommendations out today lower the screening age from 55 to 50. For
people. Also, the number PAC years has been lowered from 30 to 20.
The original 2013 screening criteria missed some high-risk groups, including younger Black people. Black men have by far the highest lung cancer mortality rate of any group. In March, the same panel of disease experts updated the guidelines, doubling the number of Americans eligible for lung cancer screening from about 8 to 15 million. Private insurers are required to cover screenings for the newly eligible, but Medicare and Medicaid are still deciding whether to follow suit. Gerard says simply making the pie bigger, though, doesn't guarantee more people get a piece.
We have the potential to make many more African Americans eligible based on these new criteria. Taking that potential and realizing it is a completely different story.
It's a recurring theme in medicine that we put far more money and effort into discovering incredible new advances than we do into ensuring that they're accessible to all who could benefit. Johns Hopkins oncologist Otis Brawley was the chief medical officer at the American Cancer Society until 2018. He says cancer's been plagued by the exact same problems.
The most important paper of my entire career, by the way, estimated that of 600,000 people dying per year of cancer, 132,000 could be prevented if everybody got everything that's available, from screening to diagnosis, treatment, and prevention. Who are the ones who don't get everything? Poor people, the people who traditionally suffer from health disparities.
Without larger systemic solutions, whittling away at the twin barriers of awareness and access means some people will continue to die, even though we have the technology to keep them alive. Some lung cancer screening programs are going after those barriers more aggressively than others. Until COVID hit, staff at the program at Temple University Hospital in North Philadelphia swarmed every health fair, church, mosque, and primary care office that they could find.
the stigma of lung cancer as lethal, and there's nothing that you can do about it. That's a large part of what we're trying to change.
Thoracic surgeon Sherry Erkman started the program in 2014, just after the first guidelines came out. Since then, Sherry has consistently driven her team towards one goal: get people in the door. Temple sits in a predominantly Black, low-income neighborhood. Community members ranked convenience as a top priority in a survey the program put out several years back. Inconvenience was one lung cancer screening problem Sherry could get her arms around.
So there are many different steps to lung cancer screening, and navigating all of those steps is quite a challenge, especially when resources may be limited, time may be limited.
Sherry's team created a kind of one-stop cancer screening shop.
So they would come in, get the scan, get the results, and know what the next steps were with a single visit.
Sherry knows the plan to make screening more visible and easier to access has begun paying off. Their screening rate in Temple's zip code is about 10%, nearly double the national average. About 60% of the 2,000 patients screened so far are Black, in a city that's 43% Black. And more than 8 out of 10 cancers they've caught have been at an early stage. Nobody at the hospital is satisfied with the program's scale yet, but even with modest numbers, there's a hint of something remarkable starting to happen. It happened for Ida Pittman and her family. When the 60-year-old North Philly native found out she had stage 1 lung cancer late last year, she worried first about her health. A very close second, how her family would react.
I wasn't real scared. I was just a little scared. I had my family members was more scared than I were.
Ida's cousin Helena Price understood why.
When they hear cancer, they automatically think death. They don't look at it as something that you can recover from.
Helena and Ida are close. So close, they call each other sister cousins. The pair grew up in the same house, have almost identical birthdays, and watched together the disease sweep through their home.
Her mother passed away from cancer. My mother passed away from cancer.
Ida knew, given their history, breaking the news would be hard. So she tapped her sister cousin to play her special role in the family, medical translator. Having worked as a hospital registrar for decades, Helena was comfortable navigating the medical system, the jargon, and all the white coats.
I wanted them to hear the straight story of what I was going through.
25 relatives crowded into Ida's house one evening, wondering and worried. Helena started with the good part first.
It's just a spot. She's in the beginning stage, which is good. And I explained to them exactly what the doctor told me, that after the surgery, as long as they got everything, then she may not need the chemo, she may not need the radiation, because they caught it in an early stage.
But the fear of cancer ran so deep, Ida says her granddaughter and her son in particular missed what Helena actually said.
My son took it so bad, because my mom died of cancer. He felt though, my mom gonna go and get this operation and my mom gonna die. They was crying and all of this, you know. They thought they was gonna lose me.
Sherry's team removed Ida's cancer with a single procedure on November 12th last year.
And she returned to work within 6 weeks of her surgery.
January the 4th of 2021, and I've been working since.
It's easy to understand why cancer's held such a tight grip on Ida and Helena's family, and so many other families, given lung cancer was diagnosed so late for so long. But Ida's success and the other screening success stories are piercing the deeply held conviction that the disease is invincible. And that is the remarkable thing starting to happen.
I'm living proof. So they know, you go to the doctor, you find out what's going on with yourself, you go do what you gotta do, get it treated and get it over with. And just take care of yourself.
It's a new chapter for the family, a story Helena knows she's going to keep telling.
I have the family gatherings at Christmas. So this Christmas, unfortunately, due to COVID, we didn't have a family gathering. But it doesn't matter if it's 5 years from now, 10 years from now, that we get together again. It will be brought up again about her having cancer and how she came through her cancer by early detection. Because if you don't talk about it, then how can you help anybody else?
For doctors like Sherry Erkman and Gerard Silvestri, the new, more inclusive screening guidelines put out this spring could accelerate a new era when doctors look patients in the eye and say, you will be fine. After decades of doling out death sentences, it would be a gratifying change. But without more awareness and better access, the change promises to arrive slowly, one family rewriting the story of lung cancer at a time.
That's Dan Gorenstein from the health policy podcast Trade-Offs. You can check out more of their episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about cancer treatment and research. Otis Brawley has seen a lot of breakthroughs, but also setbacks over the course of his 35-year career as an oncologist and researcher. U.S. cancer deaths peaked in 1991, and they've been on a steady decline since then. Otis says this is not something he expected to happen as a young physician.
When I first started in oncology in the mid-80s, the death rate was going up every year, and we didn't really see that we're going to have a huge decline.
He says understanding the causes of cancer and better prevention have contributed to that drop. A lot of that science came as a result of the Cancer Act of 1971, signed by Richard Nixon.
And I hope that in the years ahead, we may look back on this day and this action as being the most significant action taken during this administration.
What we got out of that is a lot of basic science that helped us understand what cancer is, and that led us to understand what causes cancer and led us to risk reduction. That also led us to what are the vulnerabilities of cancer and how can we treat it.
And thinking of that war on cancer that was declared almost 50 years ago, it seems like the war is ongoing and it's very small steps that build on each other to get us closer to newer treatments, to newer ways of preventing cancer.
You're absolutely correct. And indeed, one of the great problems with the national cancer effort is sometimes it doesn't seem to be as an effort with much command and control. There's a lot of different people doing a lot of different things, and it's not one big battle, it's a number of different battles. In cancer research, there are a number of different cancer projects out there. And this is actually important because sometimes I see people say, we need more prostate cancer research. I've even seen people say, less breast cancer research, more pancreas cancer research. The truth be told, that we have found things in breast cancer research that ended up helping prostate cancer, and things in prostate cancer research that ended up helping pancreatic cancer research. And so we really don't want people to think about what I call disease Olympics. We need inquiry, we need basic inquiry, we need lots of different laboratories doing different things, and then we need to harvest the ideas that went out.
And if we turn to the things that are frustrating for you, where you think, ugh, we can solve all these different issues, but here are some very basic things where we're not doing well. What are those?
Well, the first thing is we're not doing as well as I think we should do in risk reduction or prevention. You know, we still live in a world where at least 30% of all cancers are due to tobacco smoking.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've learned over the last 30 years is that a substantial number of cancers are caused by energy imbalance. It's not just obesity, it's the combination of obesity, consumption of too many calories, and not enough exercise. It's a three-legged stool. But energy imbalance is the number two cause of cancer. And with smoking rates going down over the last 50 years, we project that energy imbalance is going to become the number one cause of cancer later this decade. And then, you know, I'm a health disparities person. I spend a lot of time figuring out what we could do better to decrease the number of deaths. A substantial number of people who have cancer diagnosed get less than optimal care. When I started in health disparities in the 1980s, it was always looking at black-white differences. Now we find, interestingly, and listen to this, a black person is more likely to suffer health disparities from cancer and other diseases, by the way, but the largest group of people to suffer health disparities in the United States are white Americans.
And that is due to income differences, access to health care?
Many socioeconomic factors. People who suffer from health disparities live in every state in the United States, but the prevalences are higher in the southern United States. The prevalences are higher in the states that are right now having tremendous difficulty getting people to get the coronavirus vaccine. Mm. Those are also the states that have not expanded the Affordable Care Act. So there's a large number of people age 18 to 65 who do not have health insurance.
If you think back over your patients, the patients you met over the course of your career, are there people you still think about and you just think, oh, if only I had this tool or if only I had this new medication, I could have helped that person?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I take care of a lot of prostate cancer patients, mm-hmm. people who have metastatic prostate cancer. And we routinely today treat people and they do well with good quality of life for a very long time. This was not true in the 1990s when we had very few drugs available. And by the way, a number of people who have cancer, we cannot promise them cure, but we can promise them long-term peaceful coexistence with their malignancy. It's very much like the same way we view HIV disease now, the same way we view diabetes. There are many people who, yes, they have cancer, but it is not growing and it is not impairing their quality of life.
That's Otis Brawley. He's an oncologist, a researcher, and a professor at Johns Hopkins University. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Hannah Fulmer is our intern. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.